Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're in-depth this hour on what prisons around the world tell us about us. Punishment, Boz Dreisinger tells us in her new book, is backward-looking. Forgiveness, she adds, is forward-looking, liberating us from a violent cycle and the one who's wronged us. Ms. Dreisinger thought about that as she visited prisons in Africa, South America, the Caribbean, and Europe. She witnessed reconciliation in South Africa, a new approach to incarcerating women in Thailand, and she's well-versed with our own correction system here in the U.S. She reminds us that most prisoners, wherever they are victims themselves. As Boz Dreisinger joins us, I want to hear from you this morning if you or someone in your family has spent time in our prison system. Do you think American prisons get the balance of punishment, forgiveness, and rehabilitation about right? And if you work in the correction system, I think we'd also value your thoughts here, too. So I want to hear from you if you spend some time in the correction system, someone in your family has, think about that balance in the Americans' correction system, the approach to it, of punishment and forgiveness and rehabilitation. Do we have it about right? We're going to spend some time talking about that this morning. And then, if you work in the correction system, I think Boz and I would really value your insight here into the conversation. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR, and I've tweeted out a question about this. Boz Dreisinger is a professor in the English department at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She's also a writer. Her new book is titled Incarceration Nations, and she's with us today from New York City. Boz, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start at something that I mentioned in the introduction, which is this link between victim to offender and then to another victim. And you really thought about this, or you write about this with your experience in South Africa. And I wondered if you'd describe the work of Pastor Jonathan Clayton and what he's doing at Polesmoor Prison there.
Absolutely. I actually started the book in Rwanda and then South Africa because I wanted to explore this fundamental issue of what it is we do when we punish and sort of the ethics, the morality of punishment, which is the basis of our so-called justice system. And in South Africa, I spent time engaging in a restorative justice process. And restorative justice is another paradigm of justice that's not interested in harming the person who did the harm or the so-called offender, but rather looking at the victim's needs, the survivor's needs, and how do we make amends for them? How do we create opportunities for the person who has survived the harm to heal? And in South Africa, in Polesmoor Prison, which is a notorious prison in Cape Town, it's the largest prison in Africa. It's notoriously overcrowded, violent, disease-ridden, etc. Pastor Jonathan Clayton, who himself was incarcerated at Polesmoor about 2 decades ago, has been running a restorative justice program with the incarcerated individuals there. His wife runs one for the women. And what in this restorative justice program, the men and women who are incarcerated have an opportunity to address the harms that they've caused, grapple with them, and also recognize the ways in which they've been victimized themselves and by violence in their communities, by violence in their families, by institutional and state violence as a result of apartheid, and really come to understand better how to address their harms, how to potentially make amends for them, confront family members whom they may have harmed in the process, and then ultimately try to live a better life after release, which is all of which sums up sort of what we should be doing in a justice system.
Yeah, I just want to say, you as you talked about restorative justice and the focus on the survivor, very important to this, and you said it's what the survivors need. But this is also extremely valuable. I mean, I take that away from that chapter for the offender, for the prison. This is also about their needs in some ways, too, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's about the needs of everyone involved, including the community at large. Because if we're talking about corrections, then we're talking about a proper opportunity. Many people who've caused harm want to make amends. This gives them the opportunity to do so in some capacity and to make reparations and to engage in what I often say, repair instead of revenge. And that's good for all parties involved.
Okay, let me go to the phones here to Sean in St. Paul. Hi, Sean. You have some experience with the prison system?
Yes, I do. I have some experience on the inside where I was supposed to get the help, and I got some experience on the outside afterwards, you know. And a lot of my success has come from actually people who know people but won't admit it, you know. So it's like something I've acquired in life was like great experience in the work field, because I didn't work before prison. Mm-hmm. But now that I work after prison, it's like something I don't talk about. So if I were to be real honest and tell everybody who I am right now, I probably would lose my job. You know what I'm saying? So it's like I'm victims before, I'm victims in, and I'm victims out. So right now, it's like my identity of who I am is like two or three different people, just because I want to be honest and I want to be secure with everybody, but in a different way, you know? So it's like, it's really hard, you know, and to find others that have success, we all talk about the same thing. It's like, we are victimized out here. I mean, people are they say they are, but they're not, you know? They really want to say they support us, but they don't. Because I've experienced that. I've came out and told the truth about things. Mm-hmm. And I was terminated the next day. So, you know, it was just, I don't want to talk about the past employers or because it might ruin the relationships with people that I'm involved with now. So it's like, I can prove documentation of when I was inside, the treatment inside was so bad. I was terminated three times. I was put in segregation. I was put in the hole. I was not completed in treatment. You know, I got to say props to the Stillwater Correction Facility, the Atlantis program. That if it wasn't for them, I would never have gotten out.
Sean,
I have documentation.
Sean, if I might just interrupt for a second here, we have a lot of people that want to get in on the discussion, and I have a feeling that Boz has heard accounts like this before in her experience.
Oh,
is
yes.
That right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's very powerfully said, Sean. I appreciate your sharing that with us, because I think, well, it speaks to a couple of things. Number one, the fact that it was the exception and not the rule that you actually got some sort of treatment and programming is a tragedy. That should be the norm. We talk about a Department of Corrections, but instead, really, we're talking about a Department of Punishment that is responding to harm with harm, which is the ultimate hypocrisy and is not valuable for anyone involved. And again, doesn't produce community safety, doesn't address the harm that was caused, only furthers the cycle of harm. And then I think, too, you're addressing the crisis of reentry, of what happens when people come home, which is something that I deal with on a daily basis. I run a program called the Prison to College Pipeline. It's a college program in prison that's specifically geared at people who are coming home. And so I work with them when they come home and vicariously experience how impossible it is to get a job, because as was just said, you mentioned prison and you're not going to be hired or you're going to be terminated. And there is blatant discrimination in the workplace. There is almost nothing in place to protect those who are looking for jobs from this blatant discrimination. And all that that's going to do, again, is decrease community safety, because people cannot get jobs and they cannot have sustainable lives.
You know, one of the most moving parts of that chapter for me in South Africa is something that I think we can relate to what Sean said, which is what happens when the people who are inside prison feel abandoned, disconnected from their families. And you can understand why their families have, in some ways, washed their hands of them or think, you know, just to be sane, I have to not be thinking so much about my son who's in prison. But those meetings with the families where the sister of the most hardened gang member would tell him how much she missed him and what happened were just, well, it really humanized my understanding of who these men are and what happens to them once they get there.
Thank you. It means a lot because that was that experience of watching the people in Polsmore, those incarcerated, confront their family members and all of the tears that were shed that day as there was attempted reconciliation or thawing out of relations was definitely among the most moving, intense experiences of my life. And I think it what it asks us to recognize, number one, is the humanity, even in the person that we think of as the most hardened, quote unquote, criminal. And number two, the ways that incarceration is a ripple effect of harm and destruction that impacts not only the people who are inside, but their family members and their loved ones and entire communities that are ripped apart by this. And certainly we see this all over the U.S. I think in South Africa, in post-apartheid South Africa, in the context of townships and institutional poverty and racism that is so very recent and tangible and still exists profoundly, you see the impact of incarceration even more intensely on everyone involved, that everyone has been victimized by this system.
And especially when women are incarcerated, we did a criminal justice series. And I have to say, the most eye-opening show for me was looking at the statistics around women, how frustrating it is to see these numbers of women being incarcerated in the United States and what that means for family members. Most of these are drug crimes, aren't they, boss?
Absolutely. Women are, of course, the fastest rising prison population, not just in the U.S., but globally. And so, and most of them, as you mentioned, are in for some sort of mixture of drug crime. And usually we're also talking about low-level drug crimes, foot soldiers in the context of a larger war on drugs. I was in Thailand in the women's prison, which is very representative of that. It's a country with draconian drug laws modeled after America's and spurred on by America's war on drugs. And so the women, the incarcerated women in Thailand were primarily there because they had a co-defendant who was usually male and usually a partner. And especially as a result of gender rules and gender mores in Thailand, their partner asked them to carry this package or do this or do that. And the likelihood of their saying no is very, very low. And then, of course, you add addiction into that mix and extreme drug laws such that carrying even a few pills over the border to Laos, which is right next door, could land you the death penalty and you have an absolute disaster. And then, as you mentioned, getting back to this issue of family, of course, most of the women in prison are mothers and are denied the opportunity to be mothers because of the way that we and much of the world does incarceration. So once again, we have to think of the harm as impacting everyone on a broad level.
I thought the question that you asked as you were writing about the women in that Thai prison, you ask, do these women need healing and therapy or does the law that governs them? Well, the answer seems pretty clear, especially here in the United States. It just seems so counterproductive.
Absolutely. And that is certainly a rhetorical question, right? We often talk about rehabilitation, which is a term that I loathe for two reasons. One is that it's not rehabilitation. We need to recognize that those in the system, not just in America, but everywhere that I've been globally in the context of prisons, those who are inside have not been habilitated in the first place because they have been victimized by institutional poverty, institutional racism, lack of access to opportunities, education, social services. And so there was no habilitation. It's not a re. And the other thing that is, I think, troublesome about this idea of rehabilitating people is that more often than not, it's the system that needs to be rehabilitated, not the people. The system that is, again, denying certain people on account of race, class, gender, et cetera, all of these opportunities that should be afforded to them as citizens.
Jake says on Twitter, it absolutely is. When I asked on Twitter, do you think our prison system is mostly about punishment? Should it be? Jake says it absolutely is. We need an ideological shift in the U.S. to stop equating criminality with an absence of humanity, support over punishment. Jim says this all makes sense, but it's really hard to care about the needs of perpetrators of sexual violence, especially against children. And if you've just gotten into the conversation, Boz Dreisinger with us. She teaches English literature at John Jay College, and she's out with a book in paperback now called Incarceration Nations. And it's about her experience in visiting prisons around the world and how she applied her knowledge and experience with the U.S. correction system to see what was happening in correction systems around the world. And by the way, took away some pretty interesting observations and information that could be applied to the American correction system. We have something to learn, I think, from and is that fair to say, Boz? Would you agree with that? It's my takeaway from reading your book.
Yes, we certainly have something to learn. And I think it's a collaborative learning process. I think we are in this as a world together, and we have adopted this system of justice known as prison for the past couple hundred years. And as far as I'm concerned, it's an archaic system. It doesn't make sense, and it doesn't make moral sense. It doesn't make economic sense. It doesn't make social sense, and it's not making our communities safer. And yet we are stuck on this archaic 18th, 19th century idea.
So if you
I did want to say something, though,
sorry,
about the comment on the sex offenders, if
sure.
That's okay.
Of course.
The tweet, because I think that's really relevant. And so I think, for one, we need to recognize, I get asked this question a lot, well, what about the rapists and the murderers and so on? And I think we need to recognize that we build a system for the rule and not the exception. And when we talk about people in prison, the bulk of them are not in there for being habitual murderers and habitual abusers of children. I'm not saying that doesn't exist. It certainly does. But that is not generally who is represented in the system, neither in America nor in any of the countries that I have visited and spent time in. And with regard to sex offenders in particular, I think there's no better example of a population that needs treatment, not further punishment and harm. Because when we send those who have committed sex offenses to prison and we subject them to the conditions in there that are further damaging, we all know that they're further victimized in prison. It's considered the lowest of the low and the rung of the hierarchy of prisons. They're getting further damaged after having already caused great harm in the world. And then we let them out and we put them on, you know, tremendous restrictions to exist in the world. So they're likely to keep going back in and keep going back in. Why are we not treating them? Why are we not treating the psychological damage there that's going to actually prevent them from causing harm again? And so, again, here's where an addiction to punishment and harm clouds our ability to create safer communities. Because if we really wanted to create safer communities, we would detain these individuals and actually try to treat them so they wouldn't do this again.
I
think sex offenders are actually an example of how we do things very wrong.
You know, I think there's a conflation, and boy, I know the media plays a role in this, with the as you said, the habitual sex offenders, and we have open-ended incarceration here in Minnesota, as I know they do, which has been challenged, by the way, constitutionally, as I know they do in other states. But I think there's a tendency to say, well, if to believe that that's what the typical sex offender looks like, and the statistics simply don't prove that out. But then it's easy to say, put them away and we don't have to think about them anymore. But as you note in this book, and as the numbers say, they will eventually come back into our society and our neighborhoods, which we want, right, to become engaged citizens.
Exactly. I mean, theoretically, that's what we want for all individuals in the context of a system, a department of corrections. Again, we have to keep coming back to that term, corrections. That is theoretically what we're doing, correcting. And that is clearly not happening most of the time.
Okay, let me go to the phones here because we have a lot of people that want to get in on this. By the way, if you or someone in your family has spent some time in our prison system, you can hear Boz Dreisinger and me talking about this balance of punishment and forgiveness and rehabilitation. And I'm asking if you think the American correction system gets that balance right. And then if you work in the correction system, really valuable to hear your views. And I see a number of you wanting to get in here. So to Cynthia in Minneapolis. Hey, Cynthia, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Thank you for letting me call in.
Sure. And your experience is what?
Well, I'm executive director of Restorative Justice Community Action. We started in Minneapolis, and we've been existing for the past 20 years. And that was really started by the community. So one of the things that's really key about restorative justice is that the community needs to be involved and to be trained and to really buy into restorative justice. We've had about, over the last 20 years, part of not only do offenders or people who have committed behaviors in the community that have caused harm, we address their story. Their story is told. They get to say what happened. Things that impact them in the community, whether it's police relationships, whether it's abusive behaviors, they get to talk about those things. And the community gets to also talk about how that affects them, mm-hmm. but then also support them in a way of changing. And so what that means is that they are held as part of the community, not outside of the community, as someone who has affected the community negatively.
Hey, I'm really glad you heard the show, Cynthia, and had a chance to call in. Thanks much. Boz, I wanted to read one more couple of sentences from this chapter, since we've come back to the idea of restorative justice, and you were seeing that in South Africa. You say, our workshop at Polesmoor, again, this is the prison for our listeners that Boz was at, the largest one in Cape Town. Our workshop at Polesmoor hinges on owning choices and working to change them. But considering this history and the extremity of what I've been seeing here in Cape Town, my cynicism about this thing we call choice intensifies. Build that out a little more for us, would you?
So we often talk about the bad choices that people who go to prison have made, or the choice to commit crime. And I think that while I believe in the idea of agency and choice and smart decision making, we have to recognize that those who grow up in the context of institutional poverty and racism, which again is the bulk of who is in our criminal justice system here and globally, those are the people in the prisons. Their choices are so deeply informed by the trauma and harm of growing up in the context of poverty and racism and lack of opportunity and lack of access. So it becomes really difficult to talk about, oh, making a good choice when all of the odds are stacked against you. And in order to make a good choice, theoretically, you know, you have real options. What does choice mean when you don't really have incredible options? I think we talk about juveniles differently from adults because we recognize that, oh, the brain develops differently and young people can't quite process their actions. What about thinking about the effects of poverty and racism on the brain and the decision-making process? When is that going to enter our justice system? Because those are inflicted upon people in our system in all kinds of ways that's going to impinge their supposed free will. And so I just try to subject that to question quite a bit.
To the phones to Taya in Maple Grove. Hi, Taya. Thanks so much for waiting. I really appreciate it. I know it's been a while. Hi.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And I feel almost silly at this point because I've been listening this whole time. And Boz, I will be getting your book, and you're brilliant. You've pretty much said anything that I could possibly contribute to the conversation. I did
Thank
spend
you.
6.5 years working at it's a county jail, but it housed everywhere from marshals to immigration to DOC. And in my experience, there's absolutely nothing about the correctional system that corrects. We are turning people over, and it's a system that is largely very conservative, and people believe that they want to just lock them up and throw away the key. Well, you're hurting yourself, and it's going to cost us more. I mean, the Republicans, they like to care about the money. The bottom line, the dollars, it's going to cost us more to not train people and not to give people skills and to not send people back out into our communities so they can be functional. I met so many brilliant, talented, generous, loving people that just made a mistake and that just got off track. And we're just so quick to just throw them away as a society. And it's just tragic. It's absolutely tragic. And it's going to change. I think it is changing the face of what our country could have been.
Taya, I wonder, and I'll bring Boz in on this too, if you, and perhaps we've stepped back on this since President Trump was elected and he brought in Jeff Sessions as AG, but
Yes.
Did you sense that there was finally a recognition of some of what you've said? People are coming back out into society. Let's recognize the humanity of the people that are serving time. And even with changing some of the drug sentences, did you feel like there was a realization of what you've observed in your own work?
I felt like there was hope for the first time. And maybe it wasn't changing so completely, but I felt like people, and even some of us that are liberals stuck in this crazy conservative kind of part of the world that, well, at least it's run by them, I felt like there was hope for the first time, that people were like, I'm a person and I'm worthy of a good life. Just because I made a mistake, even if it was something from, you know, pot to something much more serious, I felt like people were starting to look at themselves and go, I'm worth it, and I can get out and I can have a family and have a job and have a home. And in the last 6 months, and I don't work in corrections anymore. I work as a 911 dispatcher, but I just feel like in the last 6 months, the hope has just gone.
What do you think, Boz, about the new administration and the approach?
For one, I feel really emotional listening to that, because I think if there were more voices like that, people who have worked in the system and see how harmful it is and were outspoken about it as beautifully as we just heard, things would be different. I think, too, we need to recognize that I often say that systems of oppression harm the oppressed and the oppressor both, and that this damaging system is impactful. Again, it's harming not just the people who are incarcerated, but the people who are working those jobs. And as we've just heard, some of them wanting to make a difference in the context of a system that is so bereft where it feels as if they can't do that. I think as far as the current administration, it's a horror show to hear this discourse return. And I think that's the main thing that we're seeing at this point, is just the distressing return of this backwards discourse, this tough on crime discourse that's just ignorant. It's flat out ignorant. Tough on crime does not work. Smart on crime works. So to be, you know, regressing back to that level of conversation is indeed painful. I think it's true that we were in this moment, especially those of us who do this work, were in this moment under Obama where we weren't seeing necessarily dramatic changes and massive reductions in prison populations, but the language with which we talked about the issue was changing. The language with which the administration talked about this was radically different. Hearing Obama talk about the humanity of incarcerated people and hearing his labor administration talk about jobs for incarcerated people, you really felt like something was shifting here in the rhetoric. And now, certainly even listening to Trump's speech on policing, and it just feels like we've gone back into the dark ages in terms of the way the conversation is happening. But I will say, by way of hope and by way of positivity, that those of us and like the caller, those out there still thinking this way, we're still at it. So, and we're not going anywhere. And so just because the higher-ups are talking differently doesn't mean that the rest of us have to, and doesn't mean that the movement, the force of change in America, is going to go anywhere.
That's hopeful. Kimberly says on Twitter, my dad is retired from working at Stillwater Prison. He lent tools to ex-convicts and sometimes had them to dinner. He's my role model. And Nick says, no, our prison system is not mostly about punishment, and no, it shouldn't be, because there's a lot of treatment and rehabilitation programs going on, but they're sorely underfunded, and staff retention is bad. And to the phones here to Jaron in Minneapolis. Hi, Jaron. Appreciate you waiting. Thanks so much. I know it's been a while. What's your experience?
Excuse me. I a few years ago, lost my boyfriend to murder, and I felt like the traditional justice system didn't kind of give me what I needed to move on and grieve and work through that. So I actually was part of a group that went to the prison. We spent a weekend there talking to four inmates who committed murder. And I've always been really passionate about restorative justice, and that experience completely changed my life. I felt like for the first time I could let go of the anger that I was feeling, because these men, it's exactly what you've been talking about. They've grown up in a situation where they don't know anything different, and our society isn't doing much to take care of them and support them and teach them. And so it's these patterns over and over. And what I left with was this feeling of sadness for our society, really, that we're not taking care of the people that need it the most.
Well, it must have been meaningful for the path that your grieving took too, Jaren.
It totally was. I honestly sat there with an inmate and we looked at each other and he said, "All I've ever wanted is for someone to say they forgive me." And I said, "All I've ever wanted is for someone to say they were sorry." And so we had this moment, this intimate moment, where it was just that we were able to give each other that. And although we weren't on opposite ends of the same crime, it was very similar. And it really provided me what I needed to move forward. And it inspired me to do better. So I actually have taken on a role as a survivor fellow for a national gun violence prevention group. And it really helped me move forward with my life. And I don't know that I would have gotten that any other way.
Jaren, I am so glad you heard the show and you had a chance to call in. What you said is really meaningful to the discussion. Thank you.
Yes, thank you
for calling. Boz Dreisinger is with us. We're talking about her book out in paperback called Incarceration Nations. And when I suggested at the beginning that it would really be valuable to hear your insights on this, it's just, well, it's changing the conversation. So if you have some experience with the correction system, you've been through an experience like Jaren just related, you have a son or daughter in prison, you work in the prison system, it's really insightful to have your observations on this as well. 651-227-6000. 1-800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. A look at the news, then right back to your calls and your questions on this. To John Wanamaker now. Hi, John.
Hi, Carrie. The CEO of the voting technology company Smartmatic says someone tampered with the results of Venezuela's election for an assembly to rewrite the country's constitution. Antonio Mujica told reporters in London that there was a discrepancy of 1 million votes between the turnout figures announced by the government and those recorded by his systems. A lawsuit against Fox News has been filed by an investigator who had been looking into the killing of Seth Rich, a former Democratic National Committee staff member, killed in 2016 in what police say was a botched robbery. The investigator claimed in a lawsuit filed Tuesday that Fox News made up quotes attributed to him suggesting a former Democratic official who was killed was behind the leaks of documents by WikiLeaks during the presidential campaign. Vice President Mike Pence says the future of the Balkans belongs in the West, reaffirming U.S. commitment to the European region as Russia continues to assert its historical influence there. Pence was speaking in Montenegro, a small Balkan country that joined NATO last year despite the disapproval of Moscow. It was his third final stop in the European trip that saw him voicing support for nations threatened by Russian influence. President Trump's relationship with congressional Republicans may have soured a bit, but he's delivering for his party in one area, and that is fundraising. Leaning heavily on Trump's appeal among small donors, the party has raised $75 million in the first 6 months of this year. On Wall Street this hour, the Dow Jones continues to hover right around 22,000, up slightly. The NASDAQ and S&P 500 down slightly. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Later on All Things Considered, it's Tuesday, and Dr. John Hallberg is in to deliver the clinical perspective on the medical news of the day. I'm Tom Cran. Health news and all the headlines from across the state and around the world. Join me on Minnesota Public Radio News starting at 3.
I'm Ewan Kerr. Coming up at 11 a.m., Garrison Keillor turns 75 on Monday and celebrates by heading off on tour. We'll talk with him about what he's been working on and what he thinks of A Prairie Home Companion since he retired from the show. Join me for that at 11.
Hey, I know you've got a life to lead and things to do, and you can't always catch the whole hour of the show. Lucky for you, all these conversations are right there on the podcast. What's There Now? Haroon Mogul on what it means to be a Muslim. I loved that conversation. Had some great calls from you. Healthcare. Oh my gosh, tons of shows on healthcare. Cost sharing. Single payer. What would repeal would mean? What comes next? All there on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.
programming supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
Back to our conversation now with Boz Dreisinger and the book Incarceration Nations. Boz, I wanted to give you a chance to react to what Jaron said. If I wanted to make sure you had a chance to say something if you wanted to.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm really moved by what she said, and I'm very appreciative that she called in, because what people often forget is that, once again, survivors should be at the heart of our criminal justice system. And what I have seen in America dealing with this issue, in other countries, Rwanda and South Africa most notably, is that what we often imagine will bring a survivor healing or a sense of justice is not what actually does. And the traditional criminal justice system is not fulfilling to so many people who have survived great harm. And restorative justice, on the other hand, as so many studies have shown us, is a much more fulfilling experience of justice and brings them a greater sense of healing. So I've heard many stories like Jaron's, and I'm moved by them every time, but also sort of rankled by them every time, because that should not be the exception rather than the rule.
Casey says on Twitter, "I'm hoping to work for the correction system once I'm done with seminary. What bothers me is that we have already taken away people's freedom, but then we go a step further and dehumanize and demonize them as well. We should lift them up." To the phones, to Lucy in St. Paul. Hi, good morning, Lucy.
Good morning.
Hi, what are you thinking about as you listen in?
Well, I guess I was, listening to the gal who had, had the loss and had gone to prison and, found some closure, I guess you could say. But, I'm a family member who my father was incarcerated in and out his whole life. So many of my male cousins, even female cousins now, my younger female cousins, and even my nephews. And each time they come out, they want to do good. They want to not go back. But it's literally the cards are stacked against them. And even from mending relationships with their own families to learning how to live in this world, sometimes they just go back. They don't want to be a burden. It's just so stacked against them that, sometimes, that incarceration, I don't even know what sort of mentality it is they go back. And it just makes me sad, because they genuinely try. And as somebody who knew them as little kids and knows them as adults, they're not bad people. They want to live and be good. But it's just stacked against them. That's the honest truth.
This must be so painful for your family, Lucy. I mean, to have so many family members who have been through this.
Unfortunately, we see it again and again. They're young. They have so many, aspirations like anybody else. They make a terrible decision, and then it layers and layers and layers, and each additional charge is more time involved in the correctional system. And sometimes, especially the majority of my family lives in northern Minnesota, transportation to even go see your correctional officer and missing that appointment could land you back in jail. You live an hour away from him. I mean, that's a huge thing, and that lands you back in jail. And so it's really hard, and it's heartbreaking, and, it's kind of that out of sight, out of mind, and it's becoming a normalized thing that's what happens to our young people, and it's devastating to whole communities, so...
Boz, you must have experience with some people who have been in prison, and that feels easier than trying to exist on the outside.
Yeah, and that's where I think the word that was just used, normalized, is very powerful. We've normalized trauma. We have normalized, in a sense, we've normalized daily torture in terms of just it becoming the norm for people to come in and out of the system. And again, when people come home, we create an obstacle course for them. It is almost impossible to not violate parole, as was just mentioned again. Missing an appointment could land you back inside. Every little rule and regulation, these curfews that are not reasonable for sane adults, And so we create this obstacle course, the impossibility of finding jobs, housing, the lack of access to education and opportunities. What do we expect is going to happen? I mean, what we have is really an epidemic. And when we talk about the number of family members in a particular family who are incarcerated, which we see all the time, as was just described, we're talking about something akin to a public health epidemic, where it is going to, it impacts one person, which then impacts the next, and it spreads like a ripple effect throughout families, through communities. In New York, we talk about something called million-dollar blocks, which are blocks where so many people are incarcerated, or neighborhoods that contain the bulk of those incarcerated, such that it's costing us millions and millions of dollars instead of actually investing in these communities.
You know, I thought your experience in Singapore was pretty enlightening. I mean, Singapore, I think of that country as having a zero tolerance approach to a lot of crimes, and especially when it comes to drugs. And I think you discovered that when you were there. But they're really serious about also having a low recidivist rate. They do a lot to make sure people don't come back to prison. What kinds of things do they do?
Yes, they do. They're very, I mean, Singapore is a very practical society and a very carefully engineered society overall. So its approach to prison is thus, in many respects, very carefully engineered to make sense economically. So, yes, there are draconian laws, not only involving drugs, but even you can go to jail for eating a certain fruit on the subway. But at the same time, once you are inside, the system works very hard to find you a job when you come home and set you up with a decent living situation when you return. So they will have companies going in to hire people while they're still incarcerated before they come home. It's a really simple concept, but it makes a whole lot of sense. They have a 98% placement rate in terms of finding people jobs and keeping them there when they come home. So they have one of the lowest recidivism rates in the world. I should note that recidivism rates are always a very complicated way of measuring because you can go back. There are lots of ways that one can go back to jail or prison. You could violate parole over something minor, and that's considered recidivism, or you can commit a new crime, and then how long after you come home are we measuring? So it's not as simple as it sounds. But overall, the recidivism rate in Singapore is extraordinarily low, and it's definitely largely as a result of the fact that there is a viable reentry program, unlike what exists here in the U.S.
Reggie in Eagan says, my brother's been to prison. They just want to break you when you get in there. He talks about needing to stay strong. And then when people get out, find a job, they're on minimum wage. They really can't get ahead. It's a double punishment, even after you've paid your debt to society. And Rob says, seeing criminals as victims gives them an excuse and lets them avoid personal responsibility, which is as dangerous as punishment. I think we ought to address that again, Boz, because we talked about that a little bit at the beginning. What would you say to Rob?
So when we treat those who cause harm with harm, then we have victimized them, and we've actually prevented their ability to take responsibility for their actions, because we're putting them in a passive state, locked up, being harmed on a consistent basis. That's not conducive to taking responsibility for your actions. On the contrary, that is conducive to creating a defense mechanism for surviving these conditions, for being further traumatized, further unable to address the harm that you've caused. And so it's actually counter to any sort of, certainly any sort of corrections, but also any sort of responsibility taking. There is no setting that is less conducive to taking responsibility for your actions, being responsible overall, addressing yourself and your identity and your choices and lack thereof. There is no scenario that's less conducive to all of those things than prison.
Call here from Christian in St. Paul. Hi, Christian. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Boz, thank you for the work that you've done. I was I had two jail experiences when I was in high school and then into college. And then I was in county lockup looking at prison time back in the 90s. And it was on a drug case. I was one of the lucky ones. I got sent away to treatment, and treatment stuck, and I made it through. But I have to say that that had not been the case for a lot of my brothers who were people of color. I mean, I'm ashamed to say it, but I went back to a different community, whereas a lot of my other friends, they were going back to the same situations that they were in. They were not mobile enough to be able to get out of these really poor communities. Work was not plentiful, and like one of the poor, you go back to minimum wage. I mean, think about it. If you're working a six-hour shift at $7 an hour, $42,
yeah,
you know, it's much easier to go back and make more money in other ways because the decks are stacked against them. And even me as, you know, a white dude, doors were just opened to me much more readily than they were to others. And so, like I said, I'm really ashamed to talk about this, but it is a reality. And I've since gone into school to work with alcoholics and drug addicts, and have volunteered down at homeless shelters. And part of that is because it keeps me sober.
Christian,
forgive me.
No, not at all. I know there's some other people that want to get in. We're a little short on time. And I did want to hear what Boz is thinking as she listens to your story.
I applaud you for pointing that out and actually not letting us conclude this hour without recognizing that, yes, we're talking about incarcerated people overall, but study after study has shown us that at every step of the criminal justice system, there are racial disparities, and it is as simple as that. From the courtroom to the prison setting to the reentry process, as was mentioned, to the parole board hearings and the racial biases there, race is central here. So I think it's a beautiful thing that you can recognize your privilege there and the way that race continues to shape. It is so central to the way that incarceration is experienced, lived, and post-incarceration is experienced and lived.
So a couple questions here before we have to close, Boz. I was interested in and we've only covered just a few of the places that you've written about in the book, but I wondered if in all these places that you went and all the people that you met and the things that you saw, if there's, you know, perhaps a single person, whether a prisoner or somebody who is working in the prisons who really captured your imagination or has occupied your thoughts since you've come back.
Absolutely. There, I would say, for one, a Pastor Clayton in South Africa, who is somebody who's devoted his life to restorative justice, who lived the system and is now working to change it every single day.
He
laboriously
seems extraordinary. Wow, he really does.
He is, absolutely. I think to the officer, the warden or the governor, as he's called, of the Norwegian prison, Bastøy Island, where I spent time, the open prison where individuals who are incarcerated there come and go. He is such a thoughtful philosopher of a person in corrections. It was extraordinary to meet him. And then I think lastly, actually, this is something that's not in my book, but it's in the travels that have resulted from it in the Caribbean, an individual who has been waiting in a Trinidadian prison for 11 years to see trial, who went in as a juvenile at 16 and 11 years later has not been to trial, who is It is an extraordinary case, but it's also absolutely common in that country and also in other parts of the world. And this issue of pretrial detention, of the fact that there are over 3 million people worldwide who are awaiting trial, that in many countries, the bulk of the justice system is made up of people who are awaiting trial. This particular individual who I correspond with, he stays with me and stays in my consciousness every day.
We had a question via Twitter here from Dinah who asks, does any country do prisons well? And you have this terrific chapter on Norway. Is the answer Norway to that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, no one does it well because I don't agree with prisons as a response to crime. And so I think any prison-based system of justice is inherently flawed. I'm interested in manifold approaches to crime and prevention and restorative justice and thinking outside the box. So if we're just saying, okay, let's build better prisons, we're not being radical enough in our imagination process. But as far as the system goes, many of the things I saw in Norway across the board were very moving, very impressive, and I think very replicable and applicable in a broader way. Certainly the open prison model and the idea of actually engaging in corrections, the different kind of staff training that they have in Norway.
I thought what you wrote about how, and I think our listeners will remember the Anders Breivik case where he went to the island with high-powered weapons and killed a bunch of children and adults. I think you're suggesting that his case and the way Norway has treated him really put their prison system to the test. What do you think the answer is? I mean, how are they doing?
I am very impressed, and I was impressed by, and I spoke with many people about the Breivik case, and what I was told was that this is someone who is clearly very mentally ill, mm-hmm. And is going to likely be away from society and kept away from people for a very long time. It's unlikely that he'll return unless he shows capability of actually being able to come back in a safe way. So he is being contained. He has lost his liberty, which is what we do when we incarcerate. However, he is engaging in studies, which I think is wonderful because when you're studying, you can perhaps attain consciousness of the harm that you've caused. And I think that's the ultimate justice, for you to recognize the real evil that you've committed and the lives that you took, and then to have to live with that for the rest of your life. That is justice.
There were some students that you were communicating with while you were traveling and writing about prisons. And I've been curious about how some of these students, do you remember a couple of them? I think you were going back and forth on email. Some of them were about to get out. Some of them were facing, you know, high odds, the kind that we talked about a little earlier in the show. Overall, how do these students that you stay close to end up doing when they come out of prison?
Overall, beautifully. And I actually just saw many of them. I'm quite close to these are my prison to college pipeline students. They've all come home from incarceration. I'm very close to them. We're in regular touch. I just saw a bunch of them last night at the release party for my book.
And
they were all there to support me. And so we support each other. And the ones that were mentioned in the book, I do remember that one in particular who I wrote about who's been denied parole 4 times. Has another hearing coming up soon, so my thoughts are with him.
Congratulations on the book. It's terrific, and I'm really grateful you had time to talk to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Boz Dreisinger's book is called Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. You'll be able to read about it on the thread. That's All Things Books. And, of course, you can find the podcast if you missed part of the conversation. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.